We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. Or visit preborn.com.
As our nation faces a host of unprecedented challenges, it's important that we use the Lord's provisions to support conservative judicial nominees, advance biblical principles, and help faithful Americans contend for truth in the public arena. AFA Action is working at the federal, state, and even school board levels to promote critical policies to protect your family. But in order to accomplish our mission, we need help from faithful partners like you to reach our year-end budget goal. So please visit afaaction.net to give today. AFAaction.net.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Let me go back to the first question of the briefing. I know you said not a lot's changed since yesterday and that it's a personal matter, but from a presidential perspective, is there any possibility that the president would end up pardoning his son?
No. I just said no. I just answered. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I said I abide by the jury decision, and I will do that, and I will not pardon him.
Well, good morning. It is Monday, December 2nd. I hope you all had a very happy Thanksgiving. And Joe Biden, not shockingly, went back on his word and pardoned three turkeys last week, the two at the White House and then his son, Hunter Biden. And this came in what the media is describing as a shocking revelation. But for all of us who have been paying attention, and we know that, you know, Democrats just lie all the time, this was a campaign promise that Biden had made. And the Democrats were telling us, no, 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 you have to believe us. For the last year, they have been saying that no, they will abide by the rule of law. No one is above the law. And of course, they turned that rhetoric on Donald Trump, who's been unfairly targeted with lawfare, especially with that ongoing case in New York. And yet here we are. Just a month, actually less than a month after the 2024 election. And here we are. Joe Biden has pardoned Hunter Biden. So a few things about this pardon that you should know. First of all, yes, he does have the power to do this, even though it is a family member. These were federal charges, and under Article 2, Section 2, Clause 1, with the executive power, the U.S. Constitution says, and he, the president, shall have the power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment. So obviously, impeachment is a little bit different. We're talking about offenses against the United States. And so he granted this pardon to Hunter Biden. So this was not all that shocking, especially since the sentencing in the tax case and the gun case, which, of course, Hunter was charged with lying about his substance abuse on a form to possess a firearm. He was supposed to be sentenced on at least one of those cases as early as next week. So this was the time. But it's very interesting that this happened now on a Sunday night. Usually they kind of do this on the Friday afternoon, Friday evening, kind of take out the trash is the term in D.C. going into the weekend so that this isn't a big Monday morning story. But what also happened yesterday? Well, Donald Trump announced his pick for FBI head, Kash Patel. And if you know anything about Kash, and I think this is an excellent appointment, you know that he was on the Intelligence Committee for Congress looking into and investigating the false accusations with the whole Mueller report. He has been a prosecutor. He's been a defense attorney. He has a really stellar reputation in D.C. And he actually wrote the memo that ultimately served to basically debunk the entire ridiculous Mueller investigation, which had served, as the premise that the Russia collusion hoax and all of that, that the left was trying to waylay President Trump's first term. And then remember the day after Mueller testified, and the whole thing was just totally dead in the water. Then it was the very next day that that phone call with President Zelensky happened, and that that led to the first impeachment of Donald Trump. So all of those things, Kash Patel has been around and he has seen all of this, and he has said that he wants to completely rid DC and the FBI specifically of corruption. And he has gone on record and said that he would take all of the, what is it, something like 6,000 employees that are in the Hoover building in DC and spread them out over the United States. And he's like, hey, go actually be cops. Don't just sit here in your offices in DC and in this morass of the bureaucracy. And so he's going to shake things up. So whether that played a factor into it, I don't know, but the timing is definitely suspicious. The other timing that is very suspicious is how broad and extensive this pardon is. So while the media is, of course, and obviously focused on the two Hunter Biden cases and convictions, the tax fraud allegations, and then the gun charges lying on his application, that wasn't the only thing that Hunter Biden was pardoned for. What is fascinating about this is how extensive this pardon is. So the full and unconditional pardon, it says this: for those offenses against the United States for which he, Hunter, has committed or may have committed or taken in part or taken part in during the period from, listen to this, January 1st, 2014 through December 1st, 2024, including but not limited to all offenses charged or prosecuted, including any that have resulted in convictions. And then it goes on by Special Counsel David Weiss and docket number, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then also talking about the other District of Delaware, a docket number. But that 11-year time period, January 1st, 2014, through December 1st, 2024. So this is not just about these two convictions. And of course, the lamestream media immediately, and I thought they were going to start this today. And after I kind of posted a quick take yesterday on X, there were already, like, it was not even 30 minutes later, Politico dropped an article with a couple of statements from leftists saying, for example, former Attorney General Eric Holder, who served under former President Barack Obama, called the pardon warranted, saying no U.S. attorney would have charged this case given the underlying facts. And then Colorado Governor Jared Polis said he sympathized with the president's, quote, natural desire to help his son, unquote, by pardoning him. And of course, that's where all of the media is going to turn their attention to and say, well, you know, these two cases, if he wasn't Hunter Biden, then he would have never been charged. And I do think that politics played a part in it, because if Hunter Biden had was not Hunter Biden, he probably actually would have already been in jail. And Ed Morrissey, another commentator, said this: politics did infect this process, but not in the manner that Biden claims. The first attempt by the Department of Justice to dispense with Hunter's case resulted in a plea deal that was so corrupt that the federal judge refused to accept it. The special counsel dragged out the investigation long enough to have potential tax evasion charges mooted by the statute of limitations. And then we're talking about, you know, the bootstrapping in New York against Trump. I mean, this is just so ridiculous. But Morrissey goes on to say the DOJ prosecutes tax cheats and gun law violators with much more enthusiasm than they did with the son of the sitting president. If Hunter's last name wasn't Biden, he'd already have been serving time in prison. And that's I think, an absolutely correct take. But so, of course, politics played a role in this. And of course, Joe Biden is saying, well, you know, I sympathize with my son. And then he released a statement saying, you know, that I have for my entire career, I have followed a simple principle. Just tell the American people the truth. They'll be fair minded. Here's the truth. I believe in the justice system, but as I've wrestled with this, I also believe raw politics infected this process and has led to a miscarriage of justice. Once I made the decision this weekend, right, yeah, hint, hint, wink, wink, there was no sense in delaying it further. I hope Americans will understand why a father and a president would come to this decision. Okay, well, I think that's a lie. I think clearly he had made this decision a long time ago. But I think the corruption goes even further than that. Not only is that just a completely blatant lie, but if that were the case, that the miscarriage of justice occurred as to these two specific cases, he would have pardoned those two specific cases. And that's all that the media is talking about. But if you actually look at the pardon as I just read it to you, it spans 11 years for anything that Hunter Biden may have done or may participated in. So why January 1st of 2014? Well, interestingly, it was in 2014 that Hunter Biden first sat on the board of Burisma. So remember the whole Biden corruption crime family and the whole Burisma, you know, issue that when Biden was running, you know, we had all of those whistleblowers. We had, you know, Bob Alinsky coming on talking about the whole corruption and the pay for play and Biden being the big guy to, you know, and how taking the 10%, all of these things. Well, this pardon now spans that entire length of when Hunter Biden was involved with Burisma. So this isn't just about a father wanting to protect his son about, you know, and this overreach of justice, blah, blah, nonsense. This is about smokes and mirrors and saying, let's distract you with something that can arguably be an over prosecution, because even some conservatives were saying that. And let's just kind of subtly slide in this 11-year span that covers a lot more than that. It's going to be very fascinating to see if Joe Biden pardons himself on his way out of office. And if, especially with somebody like Kash Patel and then Pam Bondi being the DOJ attorney general, the U.S. attorney general, there is a really good chance that Biden will pardon himself, I think. And so I think that all of this, though, was a setup from the very beginning. This played out exactly how the Democrats thought, because if there wasn't something for Joe Biden to pin his hat on and say, oh, look, this is totally reasonable for me to pardon my son for these two cases that were an overreach, even though I've been saying nobody's above the law, and clearly he doesn't think that, Hunter Biden's above the law in a lot of respects, then it would have looked very weird and almost like an admission of guilt if he had just randomly, without any pending sentencing dates, convictions, anything, and Hunter Biden being in the news and having this whole thing going on for the last year, if he had just randomly pardoned Hunter on his way out of office since January of 2014, that would have raised a lot of questions. But now everybody is saying, oh, look at all of these convictions over here, and you know, this is really reasonable. And they're not going to be talking about this 11-year span. So I think this was a setup from the beginning, not only to use Hunter as kind of the fall guy to say, hey, look, if the DOJ has set up a special prosecutor and a special counsel against Hunter Biden, then it's perfectly fair of us to go after Donald Trump with just as equal of nonsensical lawfare. Because remember, for the entire duration of the campaign and for the last several years that Trump has been targeted, I mean, it's really been over the last 4 years, but especially with that ridiculous New York case, the Democrats have been using this line, no one is above the law. And look, even the president's son is being prosecuted. And they used that intentionally to then try to tell Republicans, you can't complain about the lawfare against Trump because the president's son is also being targeted by the DOJ. And that, of course, failed miserably. And the American people didn't buy that. And the only thing the Democrats weren't counting on is that Trump would get reelected and that he would actually win in November. But I think the entire setup from the very beginning was, let's prosecute Hunter. We get this great talking point that nobody is above the law. And of course, everybody knew that Biden was going to pardon Hunter. But then this could also serve as a second purpose, which is actually even more important, I think, to Democrats and especially to the Biden family, that Joe Biden could issue this extensive pardon spanning 11 years, covering all of the Biden crime family corruption. It absolutely stinks. This is ridiculous. And what can we as the American people do about it? Well, unfortunately, the power of pardon can be used in this way. There's really nothing that can undo this. The only thing that we can do is make sure that we never, ever, ever vote for that level of corruption of idiots to be in these positions to begin with. Because if Joe Biden was not sitting in the White House, he would not have that power of pardon and they couldn't have gotten away with this. And so it is incumbent upon us to look at how generally the Democrats, but they use and abuse and manipulate the powers of government to their corrupt ends. And they don't care what the power of pardon and the purpose of that is supposed to be. They don't care. And meanwhile, what are the Republicans doing? Oh, well, you know, we don't want to do recess appointments because that might be a manipulation of the Constitution. And, you know, we have to go exactly by the process. Well, yeah, go by the process. Stay within the margins of the Constitution, but get things done. That's the point of the law. The process is there to be used. And if the Democrats are abusing it, at least use the powers that you have in order to achieve the better ends for the American people. So we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Could the fate of America's children be tied to the fate of our nation itself? Much like the abortionists who end the lives of the unborn, the left is determined to undermine the pro-life movement. First, they target the babies. Then, they come for the rest of us. Preborn stands as a beacon of hope for the most defenseless among us, preborn babies. Every day, Preborn's network of clinics rescue, on average, over 200 babies while surrounding expectant mothers with God's love and offering a free ultrasound. Rescuing the miracle of life has never been more crucial as we navigate this time of moral decline in our nation. Will you join Preborn in protecting the least among us? For just $28, you can sponsor an ultrasound and give a mother the chance to choose life, not only for her baby, but for herself. An ultrasound doubles a baby's chance at life. To donate securely, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com/AFR. Preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And in case you missed this headline last week in the midst of celebrating Thanksgiving, this is just yet another way that the United Kingdom is openly embracing a culture of death. The UK lawmakers vote in support of assisted dying. This headline coming from CNN. British members of parliament have voted to legalize assisted dying, approving a contentious proposal that would make the United Kingdom one of a small handful of nations to allow terminally ill people to end their lives. Lawmakers in the House of Commons voted by 330 to 275, so at least there's 275 reasonable lawmakers in the UK, to support the bill after an hours-long debate in the chamber and a years-long campaign by high-profile figures that drew on emotional first-hand testimony. Britain is now set to join a small club of nations that have legalized the process and one of the largest by population to allow it. So the bill must still clear the House of Lords and parliamentary committees, but Friday's vote marked the most important hurdle. So joining us now to discuss all of this is Friar Calvin Calvin Robinson, who is, I always get the FR wrong, who is a parish priest and a radio host. So good morning, Calvin. And, you know, this is just a reminder that for pro-life Christians, we aren't just pro-birth. We are for life from the moment of conception all the way until natural death. And this just marks, I think, a really, really dark turn for the UK.
Good morning. It does indeed. It's very sad, but it shows that we've lost our core moral compass in the United Kingdom, because unless you are centered on something, and I would say that something should be Jesus Christ, but unless you're centered on something, you'll believe anything. And so they're sending the message out there that to be compassionate, we have to end people's suffering. And by ending people's suffering, what they mean is ending their lives. And surely the compassionate thing to do is to be with people in their suffering, because suffering isn't something we can avoid. We all go through suffering, as horrible as it is at the time. But the true sense of love is to be with that person in their suffering. And actually, quite often we're able to come out of that suffering, whether it's physical suffering or mental suffering. And we've seen how rapidly bills like this get abused in other countries. We only have to look at Canada, their maid service, where actually what turned out to started out to be assisted suicide has turned out to be assisted killing at all avenues. You know, there are mentally depressed teenagers who are being offered a way out by ending their life. When we know that through love, patience, time, people can work their way through depression, especially if they're still in their teens, for goodness sake. And so life should always be the option over death.
Yeah, so well said. And you know, this bill is supposedly to allow only terminally ill people to end their lives. But as we know, it won't stop there, and it's not intending to stop there. And so, you know, this is also coming to the United States in many avenues and forums. I mean, there are already, you know, some measures in blue states, and you came from the UK to the United States and have moved pretty recently. So how frustrating is this to see this happening in the United States as well?
It is dark, but I'm thankful that the United States has a bit more common sense than we still have in the United Kingdom, in that there's a bigger message at play here. It's about who we are as a people. It's about how we look after our loved ones, how we look after our vulnerable. So in the United Kingdom, we have a socialist healthcare system. And so if the state sanctions assisted suicide, assisted dying, whatever they want to call it, it will be the NHS, the National Health Service, that does it. But the problem is that this is a socialist healthcare system. So it has to balance the books. It has to look at cost-benefit analysis. And so the question has to be asked, is it cheaper to kill this person than to keep them on medication? Is it cheaper to give them surgery or to end their life? These are the kinds of questions that may not be asked out loud, but will certainly be part of consideration for the healthcare of vulnerable people. Thankfully, you don't have a socialist healthcare system in the United States. So everything comes down to money, including which service you buy. But that gives you a bit more choice. That gives you a bit more independence. When it's the state that is having this conversation, it's very concerning, especially at the same time as if we look at what's going on wider afield in the whole of Europe and the UN Convention, we're seeing this kind of a death of the culture. You know, in the United Kingdom and most of Western Europe, the birth rate is down, way down. In the UK, it's down at 1.4 right now. So we're not having children. We're not starting families. At the same time, abortion is up at 250,000 per year in the United Kingdom. So we're not having children, and we're also killing our children before they're born. And then we look at the wider picture and say, well, we're actually looking now at killing people who are adults too. So there's almost like a depopulation agenda going on. When I would say we need the opposite of that. We need to incentivize the family. We need to incentivize having children, large families, and looking after our families, not just when they're children, but when they're elderly and vulnerable too. In the West, we've been shipping off healthcare to professionals. Well, we should look at what the East do. Like, the younger generations look after the older generations, and that's a much healthier way to live in a society.
And I'm speaking with Father Calvin Robinson, who is a parish priest and radio host. You can follow him on X at Calvin Robinson. And I couldn't agree with you more that we need to foster a culture of life. And I think that that is what President Trump is trying to do with a lot of these incentives. And, you know, maybe even if it's a little bit missing the mark on some policy in terms of like the state funding IVF and some of these things that we need to be very careful about, because obviously we don't want to fund the LGBTQ agenda, for example, and say, okay, now we're going to have state-funded surrogacy for two dads, for example. That doesn't work, and that is not what defines a family. But at the same time, to go off of the clear conservative moral position in saying, you know, we need more children, that's at least better than saying we want to foster a culture of death. And so I'd rather deal with the policy on that angle than have to deal with what the UK is doing. But you mentioned as well the UN Convention. And that is such an important point that I want to circle back to, Father Robinson, because the UK also has the UN Convention on Rights of the Child. And this is where, when you mention the socialization of healthcare, and this is single payer and it becomes the government, they do have death panels. I mean, this is just a fact that when you have scarce resources, which is limited like healthcare is, then you expend your resources on the people that you think have the best likelihood of survival. And this is why we had some of those horrific cases like Charlie Gard and Alfie Evans, those two little babies, just a decade or so ago, that were not provided health services in the UK, specifically because doctors said, well, you know, hey, you have a less than maybe 5% or whatever it was survival rate, so we're not going to expend the resources. That's what socialized medicine and also the UN convention supports, when a judge can override parents and say, this is in your child's best interest. And so the parent's saying, we want to get the best healthcare possible for our child. Because parents don't care about 5% success rate. They're going to do whatever they want and as much as they can for the child.
Yeah, the socialized healthcare system, it has become a death grip over the nation. And it's very, very sad. A short story, if we've got time, is this young woman called Sriksha Thirumalesh, who was 19 years old, and she caught COVID. And this COVID affected her other comorbidities. She had a lifelong condition that she was never going to get better of, but she was living with it. Now, COVID made it worse. And her doctor said to her, her National Health Service, her state doctors in the United Kingdom said to her, you are not going to get better. You are actively dying. And I worry about that wording from a healthcare professional, because surely if there's one thing that all human beings have in common from the moment we're born, it's that we are actively dying, right? But they use that term. They said, you're actively dying. Prepare for the end. And now her family found experimental treatment in Canada. And the National Health Service says, well, we don't offer that treatment. I'm sorry. There's nothing we can do. And so the family said, well, we'll take her to Canada. And the National Health Service said, no, you're not allowed to do that. And they took her to court. They took the family to court. And the doctors said to the judge in court, this patient is clearly delusional because she's not following our advice. And so the United Kingdom courts, the judiciaries, got some therapists, some mental health professionals to give her an assessment, and they found that she's compos mentis. She's 19 years old. She's an adult woman in the law of the land. Once you're over 18 in the UK, you're an adult. And so they said she didn't, you know, the therapist says she can make her own mind up, but the medical professionals, the surgeons, said, no, she's delusional. She's not following our advice. We said she's actively dying. And she said she wants to die fighting to live, which those words will stay with me forever. And so the judge decided in favor of the surgeons over the therapists and said, well, clearly this young woman is delusional because her doctors say she's dying and she wants to do an experimental treatment in Canada. And so the judge said, no, you're not to go for the experimental treatment. The NHS cannot help you. And they went on top of that and said, we're going to put a gagging order on you. They said the state put a gagging order on a 19-year-old woman and her family so that they weren't allowed to talk about this publicly. So I had a TV show at the time, and I aired the story. We had to call her Patient ST. So we weren't allowed to raise money for her, for crowdfunding, to send her over to Canada for experimental treatment. We weren't allowed to ask people to pray for her by name. This is the death grip that the state has over people's lives, in that not only does it say we can afford to treat you, but nobody else can do it either, because that would show us up. And we are the state. We have the power over whether you live or die. And so and what happened was that I went on my TV show. I said, look, if Patient ST and her family want to release her name, I'm happy to break that law. That's an immoral law. I will release her name, and let's get people crowdfunding to send her to Canada for treatment. And let's get people praying for Patient ST by name. Now, unfortunately, between airing that program and the next court case, Patient ST, her name was Sriksha Thirumalesh, died. And so we weren't able to crowdfund for her. We weren't able to pray for her by name. I mean, some of us who knew her name did, but we weren't able to put that out there for her. And this is she died at the hand of the death cult of the state in the United Kingdom. And she's one of many, many stories that I could talk to you about all day. But this is the problem with socialized healthcare systems. This is the problem with the state having the power to determine whether someone lives or dies. It's very, very wicked. It's corrupt. In fact, it's evil. And we need to fight against it with everything that we can.
There is no other word for that other than evil. And what a horrific story. And this is the end result, logically, of not only the death culture, but when the state can override the best interests of the individual to say, I want to fight. And imagine calling that lunacy, saying that you're not mentally competent if you want to fight for your life because these so-called experts know better. And I hope for everyone listening, this is the logical conclusion of when we allow the state to designate experts to say, we know better than you what is in the best interest for yourself or for your family. I mean, I'm reminded of the story out of Texas of the father who lost all rights to his son because his ex-wife, the mother of his son, wants to perform, to basically chemically castrate him and perform genital mutilation surgery. And the courts are saying, well, we are overriding the father's wishes here because we know better and because experts know better. And if we allow this type of just absolute evil to persist with the expert class overriding the individual's free will to pursue what is actually best for ourselves and our family, this is how we get to an utter tyranny of the state. And the stories like that are so horrific, Calvin Robinson. I mean, and so as you have seen all of this in the UK, you're now here in the United States. What advice would you give to those who are listening, who are looking at what's happening and saying, we don't want that to be here in the United States, even though there are people in Congress right now, and even someone who ran for president who wanted socialized medicine, who wanted socialism, or I would say even communism, to say, no, you can't buy into that, as good as it may sound, you know, forgiveness of student loans, all of that nonsense. How can people wake up and say, no, we need to stop this from ever persisting in the United States?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the message is to keep Christ at the center of everything. Keep your faith. In the United Kingdom, we lost our faith, and so death has managed to take hold. We've had wokeness pushed on us. We've had Mohammedanism pushed on us. We've had all kinds of stuff pushed, but we've released Christ from the center of everything, and that's why it's messed up. Because the secularist, the atheist, the liberal will tell you that the value of a human life is determined on how healthy that life is. This is why in the United Kingdom, for example, we have... So abortion term limits are 24 weeks for healthy babies, but for a baby with a disability, you can abort that child up until birth. And so people don't value the life of, say, for example, a child with Down syndrome. That child is still a child. That child still deserves love. That child still has value. In the eyes of God, it has dignity and worth. He or she is a human being. However, to the atheist, the humanist, the secularist, the liberal, that child can be killed up until the moment before they are born because they don't have value, because they are not 100% healthy. And so the Christian message is that, look, every single human life is sacred. The sanctity of human life comes from God. Our gift of life comes from God. We call it a human right these days. It's not a right, it's a gift. And that gift cannot be taken away by anyone but God. And the truth is that God made us in his image. He made us male and female. He made us in his image. Therefore, we are kind of icons. We are images of God. And so destroying us, just killing human beings is killing an image of God. It's an affront to God, which is why Satan enjoys abortion and euthanasia so much. And so the message to America is hold on to your faith. You still have much more faith than we have in the United Kingdom. Remember Imago Dei. Remember we're made in the image of God. Remember that every single human life is sacred. And as you rightly pointed out, you know, at the beginning, from conception until natural conclusion. And don't let anyone push any kind of worldly agenda on top of that. Keep Christianity the center of legislation, of the judiciary, of the courts, of everything, because without Christ, we are nothing but death.
So well said. Preach it, my friend. That was so beautifully expressed. And I love the way that you said that. It's not just a right, it's a gift. And only God himself has the power over life and death. And we have to remember that we are made in his image and that God himself is the one that defines human beings. We have no definition other than our identity in Christ. And what the left is trying to do is make your identity in the gender dysphoria nonsense, in all kinds of ridiculous lies about human sexuality, about the human body, and about human dignity. And you're absolutely right. We need to keep Christ at the center and always look at the image of God and our identity in Christ. And then we will have the better conclusions to our policy and our law that outflows from divine truth. So Calvin Robinson, thank you so much for dropping by and your preaching this morning. I love it. And we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and we're continuing to talk about this UK lawmaker vote that British members of parliament have voted to legalize assisted dying and approving this very contentious and I would say morally evil proposal that would make the UK one of a small handful of nations, according to CNN, to allow terminally ill people to end their lives. Well, the pattern of noncompliance has been a stark reminder of how this can be abused in Canada. So this coming from the New Atlantis, and it's titled A Pattern of Noncompliance. Ontario's euthanasia regulators have tracked 428 cases of possible criminal violations and not referred a single case to law enforcement, say leaked documents. This was an essay that was published just back in early November, and it says for years there have been clear signals that euthanasia providers in Canada may be breaking the law and getting away with it. That is the finding of the officials who are responsible for monitoring euthanasia deaths to ensure compliance in the province of Ontario. So these are blatant and repeat violators and offenders, and this just shows how this process that even if there are some leftist arguments that say, well, we need physician-assisted suicide in instances of the terminally ill, this just is showing how that can be abused. So joining me now to discuss is our good friend, Father Frank Pavone, who is the founder of Priests for Life. And Frank, I'm so grateful that you joined us this morning because this whole topic of conversation, as Kelvin Robinson was so beautifully expressing in the last segment, is basically an utter rejection of the truth of God, which is that God himself is the one that gives life and only he can number our days.
Yes, exactly. And Jenna, you know, when it comes to the so-called right to die, you know what I say? I say to people, don't worry, you won't miss out on it. You know, a right is a moral claim. You know, we don't have a claim on death. Death has a claim on us. So whenever you hear about this freedom of, because this is the slogan they use to defend this is choose, right? Freedom of choice, the same argument they try to make with abortion. And so it's like, whenever you hear that, it's not a matter of choice, it's a matter of coercion. Most of the abortions in America are coerced in one way or another. So it is going to be with this, that people who, once you open up this door and say, oh, you have a right to end your life, you know, end your suffering, how is that going to make a lot of people feel? You know, people already feel like, oh, you know, I don't want to be a burden to my family, to my children. And they have this feeling of guilt, which they should not have. Love is all about bearing one another's burdens, but they feel it nevertheless. And so there's already an internal pressure, and then there'll be pressure from others. And you know what coercion looks like? It looks exactly the same as choice. Oh, well, yes, I'm choosing to do this. Yes, I'm choosing to do this. And meanwhile, they're choosing to do it precisely because of the guilt, whether self-imposed or imposed by family members who don't want the burden. This is dangerous. And it's also, Jenna, you know, it's self-contradictory. Look, you know, they put in this measure in the House of Commons that the option of assisted dying is for those with a terminal diagnosis, number one, and number two, a life expectancy of 6 months or less. So here's my question. If the argument behind this is choice, then why are there any limits at all? And how can you justify maintaining those limits? Guaranteed, just like that happened with abortion, you put this in there in the law with certain limits, and just let enough time go by, those limits will go away. Why? Under the force of the very argument they're making. If, in fact, this is my autonomous choice to escape my suffering and to end my life, well, then tell me why one person's suffering is considered worse than someone else's. Suffering is very subjective. And, Jenna, for a lot of people, what you and I do day by day, public speaking and broadcasting, would be an absolute torture. You know, suffering is very subjective. And it's like, how in the world do you say to somebody, you're not your life expectancy is more than 6 months. You don't have a terminal diagnosis. And they come back and say, yeah, but I'm suffering terribly. And you can't tell me that I don't have the benefit of ending my suffering like that other person has the benefit of ending theirs. That's not equal protection under the law. That's not fair. Guaranteed, that'll be the argument. And that argument will prevail. So unless somebody wants absolutely unlimited mass suicide going on, these have to be opposed and nipped in the bud right from now.
So well argued, Father Frank Pavone, because you're right. Once we try in our own flesh to and our own way of basically trying to say we're playing God, because that's what we're doing, and try to move that bright line that is the moment of conception all the way until natural death, and we try to make those lines arbitrary, then there is no logical argument for why we should draw an arbitrary line in one place versus another. And so you're absolutely right, because even the Netherlands is supporting euthanasia for what's called a completed life, or a so-called completed life. And their arbitrary line is saying that this bill would allow people over 75 to decide when to die with professional help if they feel they've reached the end of a so-called completed life. Well, why 75? I mean, with a lot of, you know, I mean, because back in the Middle Ages, you might have had a completed life by the time you're 30, right? And so this is advancements in medical technology anyway. And so it's totally insane, and it's completely arbitrary. And I love what you said about choice, because if we are saying that we have a choice when to end our own life or the life of an unborn child, we are necessarily saying that we are God and he is not.
Right. Yeah, choice is choice. Either there's only one question here. Either choice prevails over life, or life prevails over choice. And when we say life prevails over choice, what we mean is that it has an inherent dignity that demands respect, from us personally, that demands the respect of the law and the protection of that life. It can either be one or another. And if choice is going to prevail over life, then none of us is safe at any time. And that's the principle. The principle of the sanctity of life is such that if you break it at any point, it's broken at every point. And this is the insight people need to have at this point in time.
Yeah, and people really also need to understand, and I hope what listeners are taking away from this, is how you can't budge on any right or gift, as Calvin Robinson very, I think, eloquently said, anything that is defined by God himself. Otherwise, we get to the logical conclusion of taking away God's sovereignty and trying to manipulate it and play God ourselves. Then we get to these ridiculous, utterly logically absurd conclusions, like a physician-assisted dying, like completed life bills, like the arbitrary whim of abortions can happen at 8 weeks or 12 weeks or 24 weeks, or, you know, whenever we all happen to agree that personhood attaches. I mean, it's utter nonsense. And the policy prerogatives will be utterly warped and thoroughly confused if we don't simply abide by what God himself has defined. And this is why the left's agenda and the LGBTQ agenda is so evil and damaging, because it's taking everything that God defined for the human being made in the image of God, gender, the definition of marriage, the definition even of family, what it means to have procreation be just between a man and a woman, and in that union only, that's the only natural way to conceive a child, and having family even be defined by God himself. And when we manipulate this, Father Pavone, then we get to these utterly evil conclusions. And even things like socialized medicine, saying we're going to allow the experts to determine. And so people need to recognize how policy is inherently moral.
Yes. And Jenna, you know, looking at this from a spiritual angle, it's not only that God has dominion over life. He decides when we die. There's another spiritual price that is paid when we start allowing these laws for assisting in dying. And that is the value of suffering. What happened to the cross? What happened to our appreciation of the Lord's command that we must carry our cross each day, or to the teachings of multiple places in Scripture where the New Testament writers talk about offering our sufferings together with the sufferings of Christ for the salvation not only of our own souls but of the world? Now, it's not that we Christians, we're not masochists, we don't go looking for suffering's sake, but we do have a spirituality of suffering. We have a doctrine of the cross. We understand that life cannot be lived without suffering, and that when suffering comes, because Christ willingly suffered for us, St. Peter says he left us an example that we might follow in his footsteps, he transformed suffering. It's the power of love that transforms suffering into a path of salvation. Now, if we start putting laws in place and declaring constitutional rights to end your life because you want to end your suffering, well, then this is going to start clouding and depriving people of any kind of awareness of how to deal with their suffering. And for a Christian to look at this is just an outright contradiction of the gospel. Again, we don't go looking for suffering or cause it unnecessarily upon ourselves, but we know it's inevitable. And when it does come, we unite our sufferings with the sufferings of Christ. Christ is more powerful than suffering. And this euthanasia and assisted dying mentality is literally a running away of the cross, or as St. Paul says, a denial of its power.
So well preached, and I could not agree more, because that is the truth. And when did we ever get to the place that we think that we should be free from suffering, and that it is somehow right. A human right to not suffer and to have total comfort and pleasure? I mean, that's basically the leftist version of the false utopia that they're trying to sell, is that you should never, ever even be slightly inconvenienced. I mean, all of these things like, oh, I'm so offended, and so you have to buy into my delusion and call me by the pronouns that I prefer just so that my feelings aren't hurt. I mean, that is how drastic they go to say that nobody can ever even be slightly inconvenienced. But that's not right. The human condition. That's not the world as we experience it while we are still under the curse of the fall. And this is why, as you rightly point out, the suffering shows us our need for salvation and that way of escape, so that we have actual hope and joy in the Lord and a patient expectation for the perfection that will be eternity with him for the Christian
and
that
believes. And Jenna, the suffering we have, those that are terminally ill, and we can apply this again to the abortion issue where people want to abort children just because they have disabilities or Down syndrome babies, whether in that case or in the case of someone at the end of life, the other dimension is it calls out love from others around us. The people who accept a child with a disability, boy, the love that grows from there and the clarity they have that life is defined not by how well we function or even by how long it lasts, but by how much love we give and receive. And you have somebody who's suffering with a terminal illness. I mean, look, this is 2024. We can manage pain. Pain management is where it has never been before in human history. We can manage pain. The question is, what kind of love are we going to show to the family member who is in this kind of distress and terminal illness and not able to function and burdened by these diseases? This is a moment to show forth the kind of love and self-sacrifice that again Christ showed us. And why are we going to go down the opposite road of that?
Yeah, absolutely. And why would we say that the best way to love a person is to send them to an early death, where if they are not saved, we know that then they will spend eternity separated from God, and that is a terrible, terrible end, versus loving them in truth, which is sharing the truth of the gospel of Christ, so that they have that hope that no matter what happens in the suffering we experience in this life, we know that we will spend eternity with him in glory. I mean, and this is why the gospel is called the good news. And we have to always promote the good news not just in, you know, the four walls of our churches, but out in civil society and in policy as well. And this is why the work that you do at Priests for Life is so incredibly important. This is why the work we do here in the ministry at American Family Association is so important, because we want to share that good news and to promote truth in our civil policy as well.
You know, I know we're getting to the end here, but I was very involved in the Terri Schiavo situation. And boy, that's like the culmination of this. You just throw somebody away because they're not functioning the right way. And there, as she was dying by court-imposed dehydration, there was a vase of flowers growing and flourishing in that water. And meanwhile, we couldn't give Terri not a drop of water. That's the absurdity that policies like this lead to.
Wow. And thank you so much for your words of hope and truth. And I hope for everyone listening, this is why we have to support life and truth in all of our policy and in our civil society, and make sure that as a nation, we promote truth in every aspect of everything that we do, so that there aren't horrific cases like the ones that we've been talking about today. So Father Frank Pavone, always appreciate it so much when you drop by, and I hope that everyone had a wonderful Thanksgiving. Be thankful for the gift of life and that we still have an opportunity to promote life in this country. You can always reach me and my team, Jenna@AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.